Welcome to the Phi Life Podcast. I'm John Barman, and with me is Brad Pilon. And Brad's got our topic today. He hasn't even told me about it, so I'm just going to throw it over to Brad to get started.
Oh, it's just my job to think of what we're talking about now?
Yeah, well, yeah, basically.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to skirt as much responsibility as I can.
Perfect. Between the two of us, there's no responsibility whatsoever. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to need you to do me a favor because I'm becoming quickly, I guess, I don't know what the word is, renowned for having the world's worst analogies online. So I need you to help out by laying the foundation what we're going to talk about. I need you to explain what a confounding variable is in a study and maybe drop an analogy so people can kind of really picture it in their head. And we're going to go from there.
So we're starting with the confounding variable. So a confounding variable is something that is that can change. It's a factor in the things that you're trying to study that can change. And if it changes, it'll throw off the results of what you're looking for. And the point is it can change without you sort of knowing, or if you haven't monitored it, the result that you're looking for can change based on that confounding variable. So the idea is, and the whole point of research is what you try to do is control as many variables as possible, and you try to leave the one that you're trying to look at as the only one that's changeable. And if it changes and your results change, then you can say that was the one that did it. So to put this into context, you could take a bunch of cars and just see which one is faster, and you've got a cross section of 100 cars, and you're like, are the red ones faster than the blue ones? And then you find out that, oh yeah, all the red cars are faster. But then it turns out that a higher percentage of red cars happen to be sports cars. Now that's a confounding variable in your colors. So you couldn't just say red paint makes cars faster. It's just that, oh, red paint happens to be on more sports cars, and that's why red cars seem to be faster.
It's
kind of like how you get speeding tickets all the time because you have a red car.
And I'm speeding.
Didn't the cop told you he just happens to notice red cars more often?
Yeah, actually, he told me that the best way for me to avoid getting tickets is to just get a different colored car.
Right. So the confounding variable on what kind of cars get more tickets isn't that it's the model of the car, it just is the paint job.
Right. So that's a good lead in. Okay, so a confounding variable is something that's influencing results that you did not measure. Right,
you didn't account for or have no capability of accounting for.
Right, and if you don't measure this thing, you can come to conclusions that actually are not correct. They're as correct as they can be given what you measured in the stats you ran, but they can be blatantly incorrect, or at least needing to be completely revised once you realize this confounding variable exists.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Okay.
Right.
We're talking muscle building today. And muscle building is one of the things that just drives scientists crazy. It happens slowly, and it doesn't work the way we want it to work in studies. And we do everything we can to control for it, or at least make it work the way we want it to work. Typically, in a muscle building trial, we get young, university-age guys, new to working out, and then we get them training and giving them our supplement or our drug or whatever because they're going to get the best results. But something's come up, and you know, we've used this term before. We once used it describing the early results of creatine. We use the terms of responders and non-responders. Right? So responders were the people who got great gains in muscle weight from creatine, and non-responders the ones who didn't seem to get that result. Interesting, if you take a look at the muscle building research, and if you have a large enough subject group, which is always hard to find, and you do a cluster analysis, what we're finding is that for weight training, there are responders, there are hyper responders, and then there are the slow or non-responders. Right? So a massive group of people, some people are going to have great gains from workout program. Some are going to have average, and some are not going to have any. This leads us into a really interesting situation, because if you have not controlled for this in some way, then you don't know if your subjects were evenly distributed, and we'll have to go into what that kind of means. But basically, this whole whether or not you respond to weight training could potentially be a confounding variable, just like you described, for what, I would go so far as to say hundreds of studies involving the gaining of lean mass weight.
Okay, so you're talking about getting to the bottom of classifying the responders versus the non-responders, or the continuum of hyper-response to low response. And then once you have that category, those categories laid out at the beginning of any subsequent weight training trial, you kind of run your subjects through that filter to understand, oh, here's a group of high responders versus low responders.
Right. They need to be compared equally.
Right.
Right. Just in all studies, to give you an idea, when you take your subjects and you go, okay, Brad, you're in group A, John, you're in group B, you know, what you're trying to do is you want the subject groups to be as similar as possible. So you don't want group A to all be 400-pound, 40-year-old housewives, and group B to be, you know, 150-pound, 19-year-old male Olympic athletes. I mean, obviously, it's not a good comparison. You want these groups to be as equal in height, in weight, in gender, in background, in it just about everything you can find, including whether or not they're a responder or a non-responder, right? Because otherwise, the results are completely different. A lot of people think that when a study says you're going to gain, you know, on average, the subjects gain 6 pounds following this weight training program. What people don't realize is that if there were 30 people in that study, there may have been 4 or 5 who gained 0. And there may have been 4 or 5 who gained 12 pounds. And then a whole bunch around the 6, right? So just because a study says that something works and you should gain around 6 pounds doesn't mean you specifically, because you could be one of the zeros or you could be one of the 12s. And this all has to do with what, and John, kind of the cat out of the bag, what you and I have been working on for the last year and a bit, is really an anabolic continuum. Is that your ability to build muscle follows a very logical progression. And I think now is a good time then to kind of sort of explain to people how this affects them and their lives, and then kind of what we're going to do about it.
Right. So we're talking about the continuum between we're talking about the response continuum.
Exactly.
Right.
So the interesting thing about the response, we're talking about specifically your response to weight training. And first off, this response, it starts off really slow. You know, the minute you start weight training, you're not just packing on muscle. There's actually a very significant delay between when you start your weight training and when you actually start seeing muscle hypertrophy, right?
Yeah, but
after
you're already seeing performance changes, like you're actually getting stronger.
Very true. You're getting stronger. Things are happening. Just growth isn't one of them. Right? So it's not like it's dead time or wasted time. It's just part of the ramp up, right? You're getting ready to grow. And then as you start getting into training, there is a period of time where you're increasing, well, John, what you and I coined to be anabolic sensitivity. You're just getting better and better at growing. Then you hit that sweet spot where basically you walk into a gym, breathe the air, and you grow. But then you have the inevitable decline where that continues to sort of slope back down to the point where, once again, no matter what you're doing, you know, you're on the other side of the anabolic continuum now. You're just not growing. Right? So where you are on this continuum is a massive confounder in just about everything to do with muscle building that no one's talking about.
Right. So you could be – so what we're talking about is actually coming up with the continuum, coming up with a way of – explaining to people where they might be in this continuum.
Well, how do you tell, right? There has to be some, I mean, as part of phi life is always just knowing the importance of being able to measure something. How do you tell if you're growing or not? How do you tell if you're even capable of growing or not? Or if you, you know, where do you fall on the spectrum?
Or just adjusting your expectations. Like, should I expect another, what should I expect over the next 2 years sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly, right? If you are 23 and just finished gaining, you know, 4 or 5 pounds of what you think is pretty decent lean muscle over a summer, you know, should you be able to say, oh, well, I keep this up, I've been gaining 45 pounds of lean muscle mass over the next 2 years, right? You have to realize that that's probably not going to happen because of this continuum. You're just at the peak of the continuum right now, and unfortunately, you're going to slowly decline from there. And there's things in what we're going to look at is if there are things you can do to slow that decline. But from a research point of view, if this hasn't been controlled for, if where the subjects are on this anabolic continuum hasn't at least been assessed, well, what is that research really telling us, right? Is it a group of people in various different stages of this anabolic continuum had very different results? And then how do you tease out, okay, well, did the creatine not work, or did it just only work in the people that are high up on the anabolic continuum, or, you know, where does it fit in? And this is why this issue is so vitally important to the future of not only people's ability to build muscle, but our ability to interpret research. If we're not looking closely at where people are in this continuum, we're just ignoring a massive confounder in muscle building research.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I don't know, I guess other people who don't read or look through as much of that type of research as we do wouldn't think about this. But, I mean, we've come up with a bunch of different things that we think are confounding variables in the initial, in the baseline of the subject group, like controlling for height right off the bat. You can't measure weight gain as your end variable if everyone's not the same height.
No, absolutely. I mean, especially since height and lean mass are so highly correlated. I mean, the number one thing predicting how much lean mass you carry isn't the time you spend in the gym. It's how tall are you, right?
Yeah.
So if you're not controlling that, if you've got a plus or minus in your subject groups of, you know, my group A, 12 guys are all 5'10". My group B of 12 foot guys are all 6'2", but they're the same weight with the same lean mass, and I put them on a weight training program. Why am I surprised that 6'2" guys gain more lean mass? Right? Like it's people don't control for these things, and it's so important. When people make claims like, gain 40 pounds of muscle over a summer, right? Well, I mean, then you look at the actual story and read about it, and it's say 20-year-old 6'6" professional hockey player. It doesn't really have that much relevance when you're talking, you know, when you're a 5'10", 30-year-old non-professional athlete, right? Mm-hmm. It's the height is the major difference there. And yeah, so confounding variables like this have to be addressed, because not only do they affect our ability to interpret research, but man, they've got to drive what you do in the gym.
Right? Well, they affect what you do in the gym. They affect the marketing around supplements and workouts. They affect, you know, I guess if you take a broad enough look at it, they can affect your self-esteem and your like drive to get things done. If you keep getting disappointed, thinking that you should respond the way some arbitrary group of people in a study responded, that you don't resemble them at all, but you were hoping for the number that was in the study. But you know, like Brad just said, they were on a group that doesn't resemble you at all. So it's putting expectations in the context.
Yeah, like if I were commissioned to design a supplement study, and I was, you know, as shady as they get, I would take a group of subjects. I'd get a group of men who are young, and I would look for the tallest group of subjects I could possibly get, right? And then you and I have been working on basically a questionnaire and assessment guide to figure out where you are on the continuum, right? So I would get people who are in the early stages, which means they have a lot of growth potential. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot of guys with a lot of growth potential who are 6'5", 6'6", so that percentage growth is going to make larger absolute numbers. And I do the study on those guys because the numbers would be amazing compared to, you know, grabbing a bunch of 5'5", 5'6" guys. Even though the percentage increase in lean muscle mass is probably going to be relatively the same, the absolute numbers you're going to show are going to be much, much larger on the tall guys, especially if you control for where they are on the anabolic continuum.
Yep. Oh, yeah. So if they're just working their way up to highly sensitive and highly responsive, highly anabolic responsive, I mean – yeah, if you got a guy who's a foot taller, that's just that much more clay you're working with. You're just going to end up with way bigger numbers.
Absolutely.
I mean, we could be talking like the difference of 10, 12 pounds.
Oh, totally. And then if you look at the continuum, right, and how it affects you, is if you're farther down this continuum and you're sort of on the other side of the slope where things are slowing down, let's say you're a 30-plus guy and you've been training for 6 or 7 years of really good, solid training. And then you're looking and taking weight training advice from a guy who's obviously putting on tons of muscle, but he's only been training for 3 years and he's 24, 25, even 26, right? You guys are in different stages of the anabolic continuum. Should you be training the same way as him, or do you need to train a completely different way to elicit a response? These are things that aren't taken into play. So are the most popular styles of training right now, and I don't want to list them off to offend anybody, but you could think of very distinct brandable styles of training. You know, are they best at different levels of this continuum, right? So is it completely irrelevant if you're following a certain style of training, if you're in the wrong place in your, you know, weight training life? And that's, if we don't discuss this and really explore this option, tons of us are just completely wasting our time in the gym and spinning our wheels.
Yeah, and we're not saying just don't go to the gym. We're just saying don't, you're not, you may not be maximizing your time to, like, you do have to change. Your training has to change over time. You can't just keep doing the same stuff that you used to do. And anyone who's been training for a while knows that.
Yeah. I mean, it is an inevitable truth backed up by a mass amount of research. You're just not going to always keep growing at the same rate you do at your best growth time. Right? It's a continuum. You ramp up to an amazing period of great growth, and then it ramps back down. Because that, uncontrolled growth in the body is what, like, cancer.
That's cancer. Good for you, right? I mean, no matter how – even guys on lots of drugs, they still eventually hit a plateau. Like, you can't just keep growing forever. Like, there's an upper limit for everybody. And that's interesting that you said that, because a guy I know who uses steroids, he even said to me the other day, he was giving up on trying to get any bigger. Like, he's been training for a long time, and he's, even with drugs, he's just like, it's just not, he's having a hard time. So he's even experiencing it, and he hasn't really come up with kind of the way around it.
Well, even in bodybuilding, with dosages of drugs and types of drugs we haven't even heard of, not uncontrolled growth. I mean, how many times have we had professional top 10 in the world bodybuilders tell us that, man, they'd be happy with 2 or 3 pounds of growth of actual muscle over the course of a year?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's much different from when they ballooned up from 220 to 260 to get the pro card type of thing, right?
Right.
So even with all those drugs, there's an anabolic continuum. It's a completely different continuum than you and I are on, but it's a continuum nonetheless.
Yep.
Right. So this is what I think we're going to kind of dedicate PhyLife for the month of June, is kind of going over this idea of an anabolic continuum, what it means. I want to get into the possible explanations as to what causes this continuum, all the different things that we can look at, both from a drug, even a genetic therapy point of view, or even just a training, things we can and can't do, and then maybe look into it. But the first thing I want to do is let's get that. We've been working on an assessment guide to kind of help people figure out where in the continuum they are. Let's get that wrapped up, and then next week's PhyLife, we can talk about that and maybe give people a lot more detail and exactly how this assessment guide is going to help. But I think the point of this tonight's call is just to point out that these confounding variables, when they arise, when we realize that they're there, the very worst thing you can possibly do is just ignore it. Because what you have to do is go back and assess all the old research and say, okay, is this still valid? It's hard to do because you have to admit that there may have been some errors in your belief systems that you built based off this research. But you have to do it, because ignoring these confounding variables just basically saying you don't want to improve or progress.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. A lot of people just don't want to look at that stuff and go back and reopen the issue, and really think about it. Like, people don't want to reopen those issues on that research. They kind of want to just gloss over and say, oh, well, that's, you know, they review it all and be like, oh, yeah, based on all the research I've seen, people should expect 6 to 10 pounds.
Yeah.
But is that really what that research is saying? If you stop and really pick it apart, you might find something like this where, that's a certain group of people at a certain point in the anabolic continuum that if we redid that research, we'd have way clearer, better numbers and a clearer picture on what groups of people should expect that. Should someone with 5 years training experience expect that? Someone with 10 years? Someone with 5 months? Like, those are clearly completely different states that you're in, depending on your training. What kind of training?
Yeah, it comes down to what kind of training works best for you. If we don't look at these confounding variables, you may not be getting the results you should be getting. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing is people like to think we've got it all figured out. I mean, for the people who are into sort of the molecular biology, we love talking about the AKT, mTOR, P76 kinase pathway, which is this, like, protein synthesis signaling pathway we've discovered that seems to make, like, logical sense. That's what signals for muscle growth. But then as things like focal adhesion kinases, new further downstream molecules come into play, we have to realize, oh, it might not be as simple as we thought. And that's the muscle part that people have a real hard time dealing with, is that our idea that we've got it all figured out. And that I think that what a lot of people forget is that we're discovering new hormones, new signaling molecules every single day. Right? We're even discovering that some hormones are not actually hormones, they're families of hormones that are just slightly different but do different things in the body. So just more molecular basis for confounding variables that we have to control for, or at least explore, and then reassess what we think we know.
Yeah, we're not all the way there yet. It's not like it's not like we have it all figured out. I think people assume researchers have the, at least in the molecular biology and the human health sciences, have the body figured out completely. I don't think people realize people are discovering new stuff constantly. Even stuff we thought we had a grip on, based on our measurement techniques, as our technology gets better, we can see more things and, answers or questions that came up in the research that we were having a hard time answering, or results that just weren't making any sense, start to make more sense when our measurement, our ability to measure becomes better, and we realize we were looking at, like you said, a family of hormones and not just one hormone, and found out that the third and fourth version of the hormone was the one that was actually having the effect, but not the first and second. But without being able to tease them out like that, sometimes you get the results you're looking for, and sometimes you don't. And if you assume there was just one sort of hormone there or one enzyme there, you could be like, well, I don't know, that thing works sometimes and it doesn't the other. But then 10 years later, when you can measure them more specifically, you find out, oh, there was four of them.
And yeah, a perfect example would be mechanogrowth factor, which is a spliced variant of IGF-1. If everybody looks at IGF-1, they're like, we think it's involved in muscle growth, we're not sure how. And then now we realize there's actually a specific variant specific to muscles called mechanogrowth factor. We got to go back and look at all that old research where we're like, hey, that stuff that said IGF-1 didn't work or did work, could it have been, were we measuring the wrong thing?
Right. Yeah. Or you were measuring it too crudely. You didn't realize there was pieces to it. Like you didn't. That same thing happened with, I think it was the CLA research, mm-hmm. the type of chromatography they're using to test which isotope was having an effect, and then they found out that the measuring device wasn't sensitive enough to recognize there was other isotopes. So the research was showing varying effects, and then afterwards they realized, oh, that's because we were never looking at the same isotope. We were looking at multiple isotopes.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect example. Mm-hmm. So I really, really explore anabolic continuum. So I think by looking at this, we're going to really help people figure out, is there a specific way they should be training based on where they are along the continuum? And I mean, to be fair, is that the logical conclusion that you and I have come to is the answer is yes. But we'll help people kind of, part of the PhyLife process is helping them see sort of how we came to that conclusion, right? Is walk you through the logic behind it. But for now, I guess let's sort of put this all together sort of PhyLife style. Is it just like really just like everything else in life, typically what we'd like to believe is a yes, no, you know, an on-off. It's more along the lines of a continuum. And muscle growth is no different.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I would say, and your not only is your muscle growth is a continuum, like that statement, but your sensitivity to growth is a continuum too.
Great point.
So it's kind of like two things going there. And it's also a continuum over the course of your life, so it's you could almost say there's like multiple continuums sort of overlaid on top of each other there, but it's never just on and off.
Perfect. So let's next week we'll talk assessment, and we'll talk of the role of amino acids in the anabolic continuum, and we'll take it from there.
All right.
Perfect.
All right. So for Brad Pelon, I'm John Barbin, and that's your PhyLife podcast.